Very much indeed, and good morning, everybody. And thank you, Rhonda. May I pay a tribute to Rhonda, and indeed all of you here who are community leaders, for what you've done. The task has been magnificent, and most is yet to come. I just add one or two things that I do that are not on the CV that Rhonda has. It's been a great pleasure for some years to be a patron of Vision Australia and of St Paul's Cathedral Appeal Fund, to work with youth suicide groups. And I'm an old-fashioned member of a church, and have to say to you that churches are doing a fantastic job. They're doing almost 8% of what they could and should do in modern society. I'd like to thank you for wresting me away from my examination load at the present time and time series econometrics, to which I will return. And indeed, I'm presently working on the theory of orthogonal hexagography. I'm just looking at how they're signing that. So are they. Okay. Now, we've got old-fashioned pointing here. I'm just going to go clunk, and we're going to change of size. We're going to cannon gun, because I'm really quite demanding what I want to put in. So we'll get the first slide. That's me. We don't need that. The next one says there's four parts to this. You're the fourth bit. The first one is, as an academic, I wanted to try and find an economic theory of community, and there wasn't one, so I've invented it. I'll give it to you. Secondly, I do want to do what Rhonda has asked me to do, and that is to say a few things about how we look ahead, because in everything we do in our families and in our lives and in our community work, we must look ahead. And I think there are some crazy ways to do it and some more sensible ones. Next one. I'll give you my assessment of where we're going, looking at, as you'd imagine an economist to say, the demand and the supply for community. And then finally, there's you, and that's interaction, and that word will come up again. So here we go to the theory of community. I define community, this is quite original, this one, as a grouping of humans for interaction. Okay, and in that sense, what do? We live together, we work together, we play and fight together, and there's an alternative. We could be totally self-sufficient hermits and have nothing to do with any human interaction, and some people want that way, and maybe they should, but that is the antithesis of community. Furthermore, it can be cooperation and it can be conflict. And if we look at the examples of biological communities like ants and bees, we can learn a lot. The left-wing interpretation is that it's a wonderful thing to see them together. The right-wing interpretation is they didn't need the government to organise themselves. There's an economic example, and that is that the notion of production in the most physical, mundane, materialistic sense is a cooperative act. And economists use things called production functions, which are on the screen here, saying that the quantity of production functionally depends on the amount of capital and machinery, labour, technology, and time. And examples of further community work are, of course, villages, which were originally, in medieval times, brought together for security reasons. And sport, that's another example coming together. Welfare, worship, meetings like this group. I was going to say this, but that'll get another slide, so I wouldn't do that. And government itself, now we can do it, is an example of a cooperative. Now, what is the demand for community? There are several motivations. The dominant ones in my assessment are the security motive. We want protection. Companionship, we do want more than just our own company. Help and assistance. There are people who, for various reasons, do need assistance from other members of their communities. And entertainment. These are some of the main demands for why we are not hermits. On the supply side, there's two ways of doing it. One is that without anybody telling you, there can be a spontaneous emergence through volunteerism and other charitable works of the provision of community. The other one is that somebody says you can't trust people to do enough, and we need to bring in incentives or laws or compulsions to make community. experiences, you probably need both. And trends to date are that we are, as Fiona, I think, already adumbrated and has saved me some time, we are looking towards an area in which the need for community is rising far more rapidly than the supply of it, and that, I think, is an emerging potential crisis. We could stop there, because that's the summary of everything. However, I wanted to take this opportunity to tell you how good it is. Isn't the economy great? Oh, yes. Growth in 2 to 4%, real, seasonally adjusted, without statistical discrepancy in constant prices, as collected by the Australian statistician, who'll be on in a moment. We were best in the West, but we've lost our little prize for the moment. No recession for 14 years. Hasn't it felt terrific? Don't you feel jumping out of your skin? And none in prospect. Yes. Inflation. Now, this is cheer you up a lot. Very, very important. Inflation has been within the bounds, microscopically detected by the Reserve Bank of Australia, within the bounds of 2 to 3%. And interest rates have been kept very, very low. If you've got any money, you'll get almost no return on it. That's fantastic. One of the highest credit ratings. We've just recently had a top ranking from the OECD for index of competitiveness. Okay, and in addition to that, big budget surpluses. Isn't it fantastic? Now, one message for the welfare communities is that we can have good-meaning governments who, if they neglect the economy, end up damaging people who need welfare control, without necessary reference to the 1970s. However, there's been an overreaction. We should be very proud that we've got $10 billion surplus. That's $10 billion that we could have spent on welfare and other things without going into debt that we didn't. No one makes that interpretation. So, of course, the budget, as the government will tell you, is totally in control, as they feel in Canberra. Well, somehow you have the feeling that I'm going to say but, aren't you? Yeah? Righto, here we go. Well, there's even more good news first. Real GDP per head, 28% higher. Young people can be delighted by looking up that real gross domestic product, the availability of goods and services per head. That's the English way of saying it. Please don't say per capita. With respect to the Latin-speaking community, it should be per caput. Now, there you've learned something, haven't you? Intellectual snobbery at its best has advanced very rapidly. The quality of products is even better, and technology enables us to do all sorts of things we couldn't do. We can dial up the world. Isn't that fantastic? And with this technology, it's the end of back-breaking work. Now, here's the hanging but. There is another slant on this. Here's the other slant. Obviously, point one. One in 20 people who are registered as being capable and seeking work do not get it. That's still not enough. And we know there are discouraged workers who are not in that statistic. Now, here's the hanging classical one. In 1969, if you converted the annual earnings of an adult worker into a house, you could get half the house. Today, you can get a grown-up bathroom or a very big toilet, 1/9, and when you take tax out, it's even worse. So all of a sudden, we can make a selective suggestion from the objective statistics that doesn't make the economy look quite so good. It is hell for young people, even the more successful ones, to believe that they have attitudes and abilities that do not get them a house. And here's some other factors as well that many of us see firsthand. Youth suicide, living alone, social stress indicators, some of the things Fiona mentioned. Now, I'll say more about that in a minute. Part B, you'll be glad we're at the end of part one. Lunch before 2 o'clock. That's a forecast. This is how you can look ahead. Guessing and instincts. And just remember, 57.2% of all statistics are made up on the spot, like that one. There is a lot of guessing and instinct, and it's not necessarily to be despised. There are people who have a feel for the evolution of various organisms and companies and social groups, and their feeling of where it's going, which isn't formalised, is to be sometimes respected. But the formal ways are two. First of all, extrapolation. you form some sort of mathematical projection based on the past and explicit assumptions, like the ABS projections, which you'll hear in a moment. And then you can model them. This is the next way we do. We try and find things that determine what is going on, and some of those go off the rails from time to time. And here's an illustration based on five famous forecasting flops. Now, I don't like the F word, so I'll try and avoid it. First of all, getting rid of Franklin. In 1936, the Republican Party in the United States, of which he was not a member, decided to do a survey, but it was less a telephone book survey, completely overlooking the correlation between wealth and income, telephone ownership, and voting propensities. They thought they had 79% of the vote. In the end, they got 42% of the vote, and FDR was returned. The moral is, check your sources. You can't survey everything. That becomes a census. But when you do a sample, make sure it isn't a ridiculously biased sample. Second example, a foreign funding fiasco with Freddie, avoiding the F word. Freddie Laker was one of the most pioneering entrepreneurial leadership type people that you can find in modern industrial history, except he made a crucial mistake in overlooking his economics. And he believed that by having a major expansion of his SkyTrain enterprises in Britain with cheap airfares and holiday packages, by funding it from United States loans at 6%, unhedged, completely exposed, that this was nice low interest rates, and the only thing that could happen is that North Sea Oil would take the exchange rate stronger, so he would give up less and less pounds to repay it. He overlooked Paul Volcker. And interest rates that went from 6% to 18% in 7 months, I'll say that again, 6% to 18% in about 6 months, in 1979, that was the end of him, because it meant he was paying 2.5 times as much as he expected, and with more pounds and not less, as the exchange rate moved. And that's the third one. I've already dealt with that one. The fourth is the FX fiasco that we had in Australia, when the foreign exchange trade is overlooked. The GST introduction in the year 2000 and the Australian dollar plunged a bit. Some people may not know or have remembered that it's only a little over 2 years since the Australian dollar was trading at 47 cents US. So there's an example. When you look ahead, some things are more wobblable than others, and you have to take that into account. And then, of course, one in your area, December last year, the cast iron guarantee that the number of people who would take up the health safety net would be limited, and therefore they could maintain the budget proprietary of that. Well, those are some theoretical tips about looking ahead. Let's put it into practice with this community futures. Here's the government view, first of all. Very, very helpful, this. Growth will be 3.5% forever. Inflation will be 2.3% forever. They tell you that one. Unemployment will stick around 5%. There are technical assumptions about interest rates and exchange rates. These are the two most important variables that business and community groups want, and the government makes technical assumptions. That is, they don't know where they're going or are not prepared to tell you, so they just assume they'll stay the same. And the comment is that the wobblability of things are more realistic, and if you're looking ahead at the forces that bear on community, you need to bear in mind a few left-field factors, and that nothing really grows with exponential growth other than exponential curves themselves. Here's just a couple of points to let you know where we are at the present time and where we're going. Wealth means the net assets of persons, individuals, and communities. And a good example is that young professionals tend to have high income and not much wealth. Widows tend to have a lot of wealth and not much income. And some local councils are doing a little bit to help them. There are huge disparities in our community in wealth, even today. And these disparities are growing. And furthermore, there are shifts between age classes. Let me illustrate. Oldie wealth, first of all, cool heads. Oldies are living longer. Well, we've got these figures here. I think most of you know the life expectancy of the community is growing and the proportion of people over 65 is rising very rapidly under any scenario. A second implication is that the sum of money potentially that can be passed on to the next generation, footnote, you don't need as much community intervention, perhaps, is now being messed up by three things: slipping, skipping, and squandering. Okay, slipping means that the wealth tends to slip away from them as they get older, as you go through into the 80s and the 90s. Skipping means that the boomers who expected to get the money are bypassed because the oldies say, you've got enough, we'll give it to the next lot. And squandering, this group is a sitting duck for shonky investment schemes and bad management. Here's just some supporting figures. This is the share of the population in Australia, which is over 65, and we can highlight that. There we are. And I've ringed here that the proportion of their wealth was fairly similar to their proportion in the population, but at the present time, it's about double, and under the projections of the University of Canberra NATSEM, and I've made a few adjustments to this myself, that share of the wealth in the hands of older people is ballooning much more rapidly. Huge changes in what's going on in our society. Our community shape is changing very, very rapidly. The wealth distribution is ballooning even faster than the population distribution to a dominance of old people. And this is the last column here is an indication of the potential sum. These are billions of dollars, okay, 10 to the 9 of are available for inheritance. If we look at some of the other classes, we can look then, probably stuck, there it is, slipping, squandering, and skipping. These figures just indicate some of the distribution figures that we have. If we focus on the over 65s, the first quartile, that means the poorest 25%, if you listed them all in an array. The arithmetic mean wealth is $6,000. That's the wealth. You can imagine there's a lot of negatives in it. That's their wealth, not their income. It's a huge potential problem here. The second quartile is $135,000. That's the next 25%. If we go to the top one is $470,000. And if we just go to the top fifth of the quintile, then we'll just bring that back again, it's $2.28 million. And indeed, you can break this down further and take a look at the deciles. The top 10% have got an arithmetic mean wealth of $55 million. I mean, this is not an egalitarian society, and I'm not saying that we want one, because we probably need inequalities and the incentives to get ahead. But this is a long way from there, and a big risk of those in the older categories of being subject to misuse of their wealth. Take a look at two other groups. Let's go boomers, 46 to 66. I'm just in it. I've consulted my parents, and they tell me that I was conceived 3 weeks after Hitler was dethroned in Germany, and 6 weeks after their mortgages paid off, and they won't tell me which one they were celebrating. Could have been either. Well, first of all, this group will enter the 65 plus in 2011, but that doesn't matter so much because a significant percentage are retiring and have already retired, a significant percentage of people who went through with me and who were accountants and lawyers and finance people were compulsorily retired at 50, 52 and 55, and most of them didn't have any say in it, even if they were managing partner. This means that there's nearly 4 million of them, and there is an increasing percentage who have this wealth, but great inequalities within it. And the crunch at the end is that very few of them have properly prepared for retirement, even the rich ones. Let's move to the younger folk, and I'm very concerned about this group, concerned about all groups. With this young group, and they're the people I teach and the ones I've taught recently, 30 to 50-year-olds, about 6 million of them. Yes, more educated, and some even know a bit. And they are much less likely to be married. Parents are paying off their home. And this is the first time in Australian history that a generation has found it more difficult to achieve housing wealth than their own parents. And unless they gain wealth transfers, this degree of frustration will increase. So where's this going in relation to people with popular prognoses? I'll just draw your attention to one or two charts on this. You'll find this a little difficult to read, but I just want to pick out the bottom line. The percentage of the 30 to 34-year-olds who are or will be never married on the ABS Series C projection, it's around about 22% in 1991. It was 7% in 1950, 35% at the last census, and projected to be 47.2%. Well, now, some of them will be in relationships, but the degree of isolationism, one way or another, is increasing. And let's look at some of the demographic inferences. Relatively more people living outside formal or any relationship, and with greater prospective loneliness and depression, the incentive to exercise or interact and enjoy the fruits of companionship is already less and moving more in that direction. And I don't think there's an optimal tax policy that's going to change that, but there's something. This one shows that an increasing proportion of the Australian population will not and not ever be owning its own home. An increasing proportion of the homes in Australia are occupied by people who don't own them and never will that one or any other. The renting fraction is 26.5% in the 91 census and about the same in 2001 and projected to rise to 34% in 2026. Now, that's partly my projections and partly the ABS. Here's the one that I wanted to focus on, and I'll draw attention to two lines. I've picked out a couple of cohorts in the socio-demographic future, and these ones are ABS figures based on various assumptions of continuity of where we've been going in the last 20 years in particular. I pick out two groups in particular, 35 to 39-year-old females as lone parents. In other words, they have one or more children, but not a partner with them. 5% in 86, 7% in 2001, rising to 11% in 2026. They're still small percentages, but when you think in detail, that's an increasing proportion where there is a high-risk category. And then the bottom one is even more dramatic. 30 to 34-year-old lone males, in other words, living in a dwelling by themselves, no partner, no children. 4% in 86, 5.5% in 2001, bang on 10% in 2026. Now, what do we infer from that? These are my inferences, and I've put this down in a quotable way. I say we're destined for this. I'll try and read this without a stumble. Relatively more people living alone with fewer children who are less likely to have both parents with them as children in homes that increasingly they don't own and with savings that are less likely than a generation before to afford them any chance of ever owning their own home. Or if I wanted a one-liner, it's morbidity replacing mortgages. Well, that's a pretty somber outlook. And what are we going to do on the supply side? So getting near the end here, be delighted to know. Everyone wants accountability. But if organisations are crippled with conformity conditions, I worked very hard on the alliteration of that one, then in economist terms, the excess of demand over supply of community will accelerate. And in this case, despite my confidence in the price mechanism with the oil market, there's no price mechanism here to fix the discrepancy. We are in potential crisis. In short, whatever you're doing, it's going to have to be bigger. Now, there are some alternative futures. Let's look at a couple of deviations. One thing that we can do is not just what the government does, 3% growth forever, 2.5% forever. This hand is demonstrative. The other one will be a change of slide. So this is demonstrative, okay? Economic trends include a significant slump. This is, as you look at it, my right hand, okay? Audience right. And revival. Well, I think it's a very good idea in your own planning if you're looking at just mundane things like cash or more worrying things like clients and other things that are involved in, and there's people involved in all of this that you're going to have to deal with. there will be wobbles, there will be slumps, and there will be revivals in the economy, and that's more realistic than what the government is doing. The second element is technology. I could build scenarios in which, with the technology we have today, we could completely eliminate the need for any school building. It could all be done by people dialing in from home. What on earth we do with compliance and assessment, I don't know, quite apart from human interaction. We could get rid of shopping centres by home shopping, workplaces by all at home. And you've all seen these scary scenarios. They are sociologically repugnant, but technologically possible already today. This is one of our futures. Another one is that on my numbers, and I'm sure that Dennis will support it, there's going to be a significant preponderance of older people who are fit and capable and not doing enough. And so how do we marshal them to do more community? I don't know. And the last one is communities in control, I say, means, and I go to the brain part of what Fiona had to say to you, understanding before action. Let's not get overly emotional about this stuff like wealth distribution and so on, but let's be realistic about it. It is huge, and there is considerable wealth and wealth potential and time potential to do more with community, especially with leadership. I do not think that leadership means this. However, it's a good incentive of the value of a carrot. And I say to you, as I look back on all of this, that we do have a potential problem. I thank you for what you've done, but fear not, the future is not all bad news. The TBS, I found something to be happy about. The TBS has shot up from about 8 millimetres in Frank Crean's day in 1983 to over 300 millimetres today, and I think is booming ahead despite all fears to the... Oh, Rhonda just asked me. The TBS is the thickness of the budget speech, and it's just absolutely booming, and anybody who thinks that we've got the paperless office has got a lot to go. Thank you very much indeed. Right. We're going to do questions at the end, so I'll tell you my community story quickly because I may not get it in the end if lunch comes first. This is a management consulting story. I'm very fond of management consultants. If you fail economics, it's a good out. No, I didn't say that. There was a football team, and it had a wonderful coach. It had terrific players, a dedicated cheer squad. They had quite enough money, lots and lots of skill of the participants, but they couldn't win a game. And they hired some management consultants who, for the usual fee, produced a report and said, this is all wrong. The raw materials are there, but there's just not enough interaction. They're not playing like community. And if you go to a zoo, you'll see how gorillas have their own communities. So they hired a gorilla, and it worked. They came from match to match to get more and more gorilla, and they wanted to please the gorilla, and everybody worked together to this focus. And they won match after match, even the grand final. And after that, they celebrated by going a long way into the country for a very boozy night. And on the way back, a terrible thing happened. The big bus in which they travelled hit a tree and everybody was killed. Tragedy. But at the coronial inquiry, the judge said he didn't know if there were any witnesses, but he'd heard the gorilla survived and he wondered if he should go in as an expert witness. Now, some expert witnesses like this. And his questions to the gorilla were these. Well, first of all, Mr. Gorilla, do you think you can give relevant evidence to this court? Was the response. He said, well, what were the people at the back of the bus doing at the time of this terrible accident? Oh. He said, oh, I think we've got this in one. What about the people in the front of the bus? Oh. He said, oh, I've not had evidence to pose so clearly in 25 years in this jurisdiction. But just before you step down, I think we've got the answer. Can you tell me what you were doing at this time? Thank you.